Hi, I'm Neil Stavem. I want to thank you for listening to this podcast from Connecting Faith. There are many more podcasts available at our website, myfaithradio.com. And your support makes this possible.
Real conversations about how we live out our faith every day. Welcome to Connecting Faith.
Well, it's great to have you listening in. I'm Neil Stavem. Ted Ross at the controls and Chris is at the phones. We're looking forward to a good hour of opportunity to listen, learn, and grow today and talk about a really important part of living out our faith. Martin Luther King Jr. said, "Our lives begin to end the day we become silent about things that matter." And for many of us, what the maybe it doesn't matter as much as it should, is the reality of global poverty in our world today. We're going to talk about some solutions. It was Steve Colbert who wrote the book When Helping Hurts, said, "Personal piety and formal worship are essential to the Christian life, but they must lead to lives that act justly and love mercy," from Micah 6:8. So what does that look like today? We're going to get a firsthand account of how we can see a change take place in alleviating poverty. So we're going to talk with Peter Greer, President and CEO of Hope International. It's a global Christ-centered microenterprise development organization serving throughout Africa, Asia, Latin America, and Eastern Europe. So it's going to be a good conversation just ahead.
Hope-filled, and a lot of people are looking for hope, I think, especially in these dreary winter days.
It's true.
And we have a great program that follows us here on Faith Radio that provides a lot of hope.
That's true. A new program just started the first of the year, Destined for Victory, with Paul Shepherd. And just want to let you know about that. If you're not familiar with Faith Radio, maybe new or maybe listening on the Faith Radio Network app and so haven't really checked out the schedule yet, you can go to myfaithradio.com to find out the full program schedule. But just a little heads up about that new program. We're excited about that edition, Destined for Victory.
Good to just hang on to that title. That's a good reminder. We are destined for victory.
Indeed we are. I came across this verse from Isaiah 58:10 and thought it was a good way to set up our conversation today. It says, "If you spend yourselves on behalf of the hungry and satisfy the needs of the oppressed, then your light will rise in the darkness, and your night will become like the noonday." I think it's interesting that we're talk poverty alleviation on the day when the Dow Jones Industrial Average reached historic records today, breaking 20,000 points for the first time in the week when President Trump began to put his agenda in place. Well, let's talk about we'll meet another president today and talk a little bit about his agenda, and actually about God's agenda for the poor and how we can be a part of it as his people. Peter Greer is president and CEO of Hope International. Again, a global Christ-centered microenterprise development organization working throughout the world. Peter joined Hope before that. He worked internationally as a microfinance advisor in Cambodia and as a technical advisor for self-help development foundations in Zimbabwe. He's also serving in a bank in Rwanda and has written several books. In fact, last time we talked to Peter, it was about his latest book, 40-40 Vision, Clarifying Your Mission in Midlife. And maybe during our conversation today, you might experience a little more clarity about your vision, about what God's called you to do. So, Peter, welcome back to Connecting Faith.
I really appreciate it. Thanks for having me.
So we want to talk about, you've got a new book that's available on your website, hopeinternational.org, called Created to Flourish, How Employment-Based Solutions Eradicate Poverty. And I want to talk a little bit about, what's happening in the world in the efforts to alleviate poverty. And I guess maybe for most of us, we should talk first of all about, do we take the possibility of meaningful work here, at least in the U.S., kind of for granted, because many people just survival is what they're hoping for.
Yeah, you're exactly right. And, it's an interesting question. When you travel, if you go on short-term trips or if you spend more time in an international context, oftentimes we show up in those settings with our solutions. We think about the food that we're going to give away. We think about the buildings we're going to build. We think about the way that we're going to provide for the needs of others. But if you go on those trips enough time and if you ask a question, a very different question, not what are we going to give you, but if you ask a different question to the people that you're there to get to know, the people that you're there to serve, and you say, how can we help you? You will hear a different response. And as I've traveled around the world, as I've asked that question to individuals in places of material poverty, when I ask, how can we help you or what would you like, the response is not food. The response is not clothing. The response is not even a new house. The response is, we would like a job. We would like the opportunity to use our God-given gifts and abilities to provide for ourselves so that we're not dependent on the charity of others. And that changes everything. If that really is what individuals around the world are asking for, the gift of a job, the gift of work, it changes our response. And, you know, I saw a statistic. It's from a study that Duke University did, and I saw Jobs for Life, a great organization, share this with me. But it talked about in the U.S., when churches respond to the issue of poverty, the primary way that we respond is from food, housing, clothing. The very bottom of the list, the least common way that individuals respond to this issue of poverty is through anything having to do with employment or job creation or entrepreneurship. And so we're trying to figure out why is that and how can we help the church as we respond to this issue of global poverty. How can we recognize that there's a gift of work, there's a gift of a job, and it is an integral part of who, of how God created us.
Is it because to give the gift of work takes a lot of work? I mean, it's not a sort of short-term, easily packaged solution, I guess.
Neil, you are exactly right. If the metric that we're doing is what's the quick fix, it is far easier to give someone a meal. It's far easier to give someone a loaf of bread than to walk with them, to work with them, equip them to patiently plant seeds, to watch wheat, to watch it be ground. And yet I just believe that if we really were concerned about the welfare, about the well-being, about God's glory being reflected in the person that we're there to help, we wouldn't say, what is the quickest solution? We'd say, what's the best solution? And I think that's what Jesus was talking about when he was asked, what's the most important commandment? And his response was, love God and love your neighbor. And then there's that qualifier. It's to love your neighbor as yourself. And so I think that it's not just what is quick. It's not just what is easy. I think the better question is what really is going to make a lasting impact. And I'm of the firm belief that if you have an option, that a hand up is going to be superior in the long term than another handout. So how do we shift from aid to thinking about the gift of work, the gift of entrepreneurship? How do we not settle delivering bread? How do we help individuals patiently grow their own bread-baking businesses? That's what I'm excited to figure out how we do more of.
We're talking about, you know, how employment-based solutions can eradicate poverty. Peter Greer's new book is called Created to Flourish. You're talking about meaningful work. Maybe we need to define that. What do we mean by meaningful work? And is that an important qualifier?
Yeah, you referenced earlier Steve Corbett and Brian Fickert's book, When Helping Hurts, and I really appreciate that. It's a terrific resource. And in that, they talk about the problem. What's the problem that we're trying to fix? And they talk about the broken relationships with God, broken relationships with each other, a marred sense of self and who God created us to be, and a broken relationship with the earth, with environment, with the material world. And so I believe that meaningful work has an opportunity to see restoration in those four areas. When I think about meaningful work, I think about the ability to use gifts and abilities to realize that God has given you gifts and abilities. You are made unique. To have the ability to do something that you're good at. I think about the possibility to not just do meaningful work, but do it with others, other people that you get to work with, people that you get to influence, people that get to influence you, and the gift of those relationships with people that you're going to spend a lot of time with, and to productively contribute, not just to meeting the needs of your family, but truly starting to figure out how do we provide goods and services that are going to have a positive impact on the people that are around us, while also being a wise steward of the world in which God created and said it was good. So I think about work as part of the process of seeing restoration. And, you know, maybe on a more practical point, I can tell you, you end up spending time with individuals that have had their head down and their hand up waiting for some form of charity. That is not good. That does not reinforce the identity. You put someone who has been a long-term recipient of charity and you invest in them. You give them the opportunity to have a job, and it literally changes the posture. They stand taller, their head is higher, their shoulders are back. The gift of meaningful work has this ability to truly transform the posture from hand out and head down to standing tall and saying, look what God has gifted me with. Look at what I am able to do. Look at the way that I'm able to provide for my family. Look at the way that I'm able to serve my customers. Literally, the posture changes.
We'll talk more about how that can change and how the church can be integrally involved in this. I'm curious, Peter, you're present CEO of Hope International now, but you you spent some time working as a microfinance advisor, and you were in banking and development. So has this been kind of a passion of yours from all along, or was it as a result of your getting involved in development work that you realized that, you know, we may not be doing it all the right way?
Yeah, so I originally I grew up as a pastor's kid. I grew up going on mission trips and had the incredible fortune of visiting places of financial poverty. And oftentimes, I would do the traditional response. I would go, and we'd be part of a building. We'd be part of some sort of a food distribution or some sort of an outdoor vacation Bible school. And all of those things are good and appropriate. But it struck me as I was doing this that oftentimes we'd go back to the same communities and the situation never changed. It was always the foreigners come in and then the ministry happens, or the foreigners come in and then the building projects happen. And I have grown to realize that whenever we have a foreigner coming in and doing for other model, that we might actually be robbing the local church of the gift and privilege it is for them to realize they have gifts and abilities. They have been given things by God that can be used in the service of God and in the service of others. And so really starting with this shift of saying, instead of having a foreign coming in model, what if we had a different model that started with a question, what has God already gifted and equipped the individuals in that community with? And then how can we support the local church in using those gifts, those abilities? So instead of a foreign import model, it's looking what is already there, equipping and mobilizing. And part of that, I did get fascinated by this idea of entrepreneurship and kingdom businesses and figuring out the gift of work. And so it has been my passion. You mentioned I started in Cambodia and then went to Rwanda and then Zimbabwe, really trying to figure out how do we do this effectively, Christ-centered microenterprise development, grow enterprises, grow businesses, unlock entrepreneurship, and do it in such a way that the kingdom of God is advanced and that individuals are impacted in all of those domains that we were just talking about.
We'll get into talking a little bit about microfinance, fair trade, some of the barriers to seeing employment-based solutions eradicate poverty. More with Peter Greer coming up in a moment here on Connecting Faith. Peter's president and CEO of Hope International. You can find out more about their great ministry, and you can also download a copy of Peter's new book, Created to Flourish. It's available at hopeinternational.org. Peter's written a number of books, including The Poor Will Be Glad, The Spiritual Danger of Doing Good, Mission Drift, and 40-40 Vision. And he's our guest today on Connecting Faith. Phil Smith had written a new book together called Created to Flourish, and then we're going to explore the church's call to respond to families living in poverty and discuss some practical ways to get involved. That's what we want to talk about today. Glad to have Peter Greer with us. As he's president and CEO of Hope International. It's a global, Christ-centered microenterprise development organization, and it serves throughout Africa, Asia, Latin America, and Eastern Europe. And Peter's seldom in one place very long, and so we're honored to have him with us today to just take a few minutes to talk about alleviating poverty through employment-based solutions. And let's talk a little bit about microloans. Those are something that we've become a bit more familiar with, but is that one of the keys? If we're looking at solutions, does it start with those that have, providing some loans for those that need?
Yeah, you know, I think it starts with this idea in changing the way that we look at individuals born into poverty. And whether or not we admit this, sometimes we have a bit of a paternalistic approach to thinking about people in need, thinking if only they would work harder, if only they would do this, if only they would do that. And yet, when you spend time in places of financial poverty, I personally have seen people that work so hard, work circles around me. I have seen individuals that have so much intelligence, have great ideas. And I remember talking with a friend that was doing some business coaching and business training in the former Soviet Union. And at the end of this coaching time, individuals had developed a plan for these businesses that were going to have a positive impact, connect to the church, be used as an outreach tool. And at the end of this training, he said, kind of in the culmination of the entire training, he said, "Now, how many of you are ready to go out and start your businesses?" And he would have hoped, he was kind of anticipating, you know, the hands go up, it's this rallying cry, and not one hand went up. And he said, "Wait a minute, I've read your plans, I've spent this time with you, I know you're ready to do this." And they said, "There's no one, there's no way we could get the capital. There's no way someone would invest in us at this moment." And so all of these good ideas, if it's not also matched with some form of investment, means that good ideas stay between our ears but never actually happen. And so access to capital is a big deal. And maybe that doesn't sound like a kind of, you know, traditional missions activity, but I think it is so important. It's important to help people to dream. It's important that we help people plan. It's important that we help people recognize the worth and dignity and ability that they have. And in addition to all that, it also is really important that we provide capital. Around the world, Hope International serves almost a million families, and the way that we do it is by providing capital, training, discipleship into promising entrepreneurs in places of poverty. And just one indicator, we over the past 5 years have had 98% of all of our loans that we've given to all of these individuals around the world, they've been repaid. And so it really changes our perception of people in poverty. These are capable, hardworking individuals that oftentimes need a little bit more coaching, a little bit more training, but they also need someone to believe in them enough that they're going to invest in them. So we are investors as well as very much having at our core this discipleship model and methodology, trying to change the way that the church responds to this issue of global poverty.
Right. Have you talked a little bit more about that discipleship-based focus? But tell me a little bit more. I mean, when you're talking about the loans and ideas and investment, producers need markets. So how do you develop those?
Oftentimes we find that the market already is in existence. And, you know, maybe sometimes when you hear these terms, you think about these large enterprises. We start out at a very micro level. Sometimes they grow to become much larger. But I think of Aura, a woman that I spent time with, and I entered into her home, and I got to see that her business, she had this idea that she could provide and manufacture shampoo in her home. And so she had this large kind of pot. She had her ingredients that she was putting in. She wouldn't tell us exactly what was in her secret recipe. And that day that we were there, she was experimenting with different scents. And so she was making shampoo, but she was packaging it in a self-service unit, so a single unit. And so in that example, her competition was, you know, Pantene Pro-V. She was trying to manufacture locally using locally available materials and to, at a lower price, provide shampoo for her community in a way that was actually increasing not just her income, but then all the other producers of the supplies. And so that's at a very micro level. There was a market there. She was just trying to do a little bit more to provide a comparable or better product at a lower price point, make it available in single serving sizes, and she had this iron that she was using to make it. So that's an example, but whether it is barbers, whether it is markets, whether it is agriculture and building a greenhouse, oftentimes these are not for external export, but these are opportunities to start or expand at a micro level enterprises that can service the community in which the individuals are living. Now, certainly sometimes that grows and you get connected to external markets, but there is a lot of opportunity even within the different markets where we work, starting at a very micro level.
Can a microloan is going to help one family? Are there ways to expand that, duplicate that, replicate that, so that a whole community can be improved and upgraded?
Yeah, there's no question. I think about a conversation that I had last week with Andre. Andre had started an enterprise. It was in a closed country context, and due to some other factors, he ended up needing to shut down that particular enterprise. And he got a letter later that the result of that was this significant hardship. And they did a little research, and there were 650 individuals that were experiencing significant food insecurity. They didn't know where their food was going to come from. And they said that this was the direct result. And Andre said, but wait a minute, we were only employing 20 people. How is it possible that this is so widespread? And it turns out that it was those 20 individuals, it was the jobs of those 20 that was then providing all of the other economic activity. It was the barbers, it was the grocery store. And so I really do believe a small number of individuals that are able to expand, are able to launch enterprises, that does have the potential of having a significant community impact. And maybe everywhere the ratio is not 20 jobs are going to support the equivalent of 650 people, but I know there is a multiplication impact. You get a core group of people working hard. You get a core group of people that then are buying the supplies and using the services around them, and you can see a pathway out of poverty. And again, my heart in this is to say, how can we do that in such a way that there is an ability for individuals to see Christ in the midst of doing this sort of work?
Talking more about that in the moments ahead with Peter Greer, President and CEO of Hope International. It's a Christ-centered microenterprise development organization working around the globe. And Peter has written a new book called Created to Flourish, How Employment-Based Solutions Eradicate Poverty. You can download a copy at hopeinternational.org. You can join our conversation at 877-933-2484, 877-93-FAITH. We're going to come back and talk about why discipleship is a key part of Hope International's ministry just ahead. Do something, but we want to do it right. We want to do it in a way that is going to build hope and to help those that are in need flourish. Meaningful work is the engine of human flourishing. And we all have God-breathed gifts and passions, and when we use those gifts, we reflect our Creator. And so how do we use employment-based solutions to eradicate poverty? That's what we're talking about today with Peter Greer. Created to Flourish is a new book that Peter and Phil Smith have co-written. Peter is President and CEO of Hope International, and you can find out more about their great ministry and his other books as well at hopeinternational.org. It's a global Christ-centered microfinance organization serving through much of the globe, and he's an advocate for the church's role in missions and alleviating extreme poverty. Peter, you've talked to, mentioned a couple times that this is through discipleship-based groups. Talk about why discipleship is a key part of what Hope International is all about, and what does that mean?
You know, when I first started in this work, I was living and serving in Rwanda, and while I was in Rwanda, I was so excited to try out this tool of microenterprise development, and so helped an individual start a business. His business was growing, and I ended up having the opportunity to drive him home. I didn't just help him start the business. I was also one of his clients for a gardening business, and as I drove him home, I remember my shock that as I dropped him off, his house was a picture of poverty. It was not at all what I was led to believe, that if someone has a job, if someone has work, that their life is going to be positively impacted. His kids were in bare feet. It was a dirt floor. And so I thought maybe there's just not enough time. So went back a few months later, dropped him off again. And it was the same situation. And what I discovered was that he was making more money, but he had an alcohol addiction, he had a gambling addiction, and all of his profits translated into absolute positive impact for his family or himself. And in many ways, it just enabled what was in his heart. It just enabled the vices. And that story stands in such stark contrast to so many of the other entrepreneurs that I've seen that have, yes, started businesses, yes, experienced material prosperity, but also had a heart transformation where the gospel has changed their lives forever and has not just given them hope for the future, it's given them a motivation and a worldview to love and serve their neighbors right now in a significant way. And so I'm not passionate about the tool of microenterprise. I'm passionate about how the church can use this for a holistic impact where, yes, it's providing jobs, but discipleship is at the core. It's teaching individuals the scandalous and wonderful message of grace found in Jesus Christ, doing it as we're enabling people to start companies, to unlock entrepreneurship. And I believe that that is a powerful force. And that's true around the world. I think that's true in our own backyards as well. The power of individuals that, yes, are growing, yes, are providing jobs, but are doing it with a heart that is so focused on serving Jesus in the midst of that. That's what I am most passionate about.
Well, that really sounds like truly you're breaking the cycle of dependency. I mean, there are various ways to alleviate poverty, but to break that cycle, I mean, that comes as people come to know the grace and truth of Christ. Right?
That's exactly right. Yeah, and I really appreciate there's an author, Bob Lupton, who wrote a book called Toxic Charity, and he details what I believe is the common experience for churches that are involved in short-term missions, where he talks about the first time that you go and show up in a community, you give away what you've packed, and there's appreciation. And so we go back, we raise more money, we go back to the same community a second time, and it's not appreciation, but it's anticipation. And then the third year, we do the same model of giving away more things that have been generously supplied, and there's a sense of expectation. The fourth year, we do this same sort of an approach of giving away things, and there's this sense that we've actually created entitlement. And then the last time we go, and we do it one more time, and we see that there's an attitude of dependency. And so that cycle of dependency that you just referenced, I think that cycle is just, it needs to be broken. It needs to be broken in the way that we love and serve our global neighbors. It's possible that the way that we're going about helping is actually causing more dependency, more hopelessness as a result of a model that is good in a short-term relief situation, but simply is not the right long-term solution. We just don't want people to become charity cases. We want them to become individuals with gifts and abilities empowered to serve God and to serve their neighbors. And I think employment is a key part of that.
Well, the North American Church has certainly been growing in their interest in justice. So let's talk about some tangibles. What should our role be when we're engaging those in poverty? And we've talked about some things that aren't helpful, but what does it actually mean? Do we partner with, find the right kind of agencies to partner with? You know, is it about giving money, expertise, or what would be a good takeaway today for those that say, "Here's I'm on the missions committee of my church. Here's some things we can do differently."
Yeah, I think it starts by not being afraid to ask some of the important questions. The questions about, is this about us going in and doing for others what they are very capable of doing for themselves? Is it possible that even in the language that we use, it reinforces the problems? Are we honoring? Are we showing individuals that they are loved, that there is dignity? So I think it starts with asking some important questions. I think the second piece is getting involved locally, all around us. There are opportunities to go and serve and equip individuals. And organizations like the Chalmers Center or Jobs for Life are wonderful organizations serving locally and trying to change this paradigm, again, from a model of aid to a model that says, let's help individuals grow in their relationship with God, and let's help them be prepared for meaningful work. And then I think on an international scale, it's perhaps rare that individuals will have the expertise and ability and time to go and kind of move to another country, although I would be remiss if I didn't say, and Hope International does have openings around the world. But for many of us, the question is, how can we use the treasure that God has given us? How can we support organizations? And so I'm thrilled. This is beyond just Hope International, but Hope International and other organizations, I believe, are bringing a creative and different approach to this question about global poverty, and very much living out what you referenced at the beginning, the Isaiah 58, this idea of seeing and responding to needs around the world. And I think that there's a new movement to say, how do we do that effectively, and to see work as an integral part of the solution as we address global poverty and as we want to see individuals and communities flourish around the world.
Are the obstacles, are the barriers the same today than maybe they were even 10 years ago or a generation ago? And how have you been able to overcome those, or what are the biggest challenges?
You know, one of the most encouraging things is I think the understanding of these issues has changed. There has been a changed mindset. And 10 years ago, there might have been more questions from a missions committee about, you know, what do you mean, job or entrepreneurship as part of missions? Aren't we just supposed to give everything away? I think that conversation has changed in many churches, and there's a growing recognition, again, that helping individuals have a job is part of loving our neighbors. And so I think that has changed. There's more understanding, acceptance that this is an important tool that we maybe haven't used very often in the past. I think the other thing that has changed is there are certain parts of the world that are hard to get into, and using this sort of an approach, using employment and entrepreneurship or investment, using those skills allows you to have access to areas. And I'm not able to share about all of the details of what that looks like on the radio, but I can tell you that this approach has opened doors to places that historically have been very hard to reach. And so I think there is a global opening, even as there's perhaps a closing to more traditional missions models, there is an opening to this sort of employment-based to missions as well that I find very, very exciting.
Mm. What's your assessment of maybe U.S. government policy as it relates to poverty alleviation? Are we catching up to doing it a little better?
Yeah, you know, I think that oftentimes the church has the invitation to dramatically impact culture, and oftentimes I think government is kind of downstream, and so I get excited about kind of the pioneering work that I see happening right now, and I hope that that is continued to be supported. I hope that it continues to be an area. I hope that things like the way in which charitable giving is addressed, I hope that that continues to be supported as well. But But I don't spend a whole lot of time on those issues, Neil. I spend much more time saying within the context. I'm so glad other people have that calling and influence. I spend most of my time thinking about, so how do we really implement with excellence regardless of the environment? And, you know, this was kind of the piece of Mission Drift as well. Having clarity of our mission that is the anchor that will hold us regardless of what is happening on other levels, that I think is perhaps the most significant piece, that we know our mission, we know what we're about, and staying true to that regardless of the conversation, regardless of some of the other issues, has been very helpful for us as an organization.
Well, we're talking a little bit sort of in referencing the North American church, but I guess the reality is that this is not only helping us in the West to have a clearer vision, but it's certainly helping to enlarge and strengthen the church in these areas of poverty as well, to really be change agents in their communities.
Yeah, and I think that's one of the most exciting things about this sort of a model or this sort of an approach. I imagine, what would it be like? What would the impact be if we simply said, our mandate, it hasn't changed for 2,000 years. Love God, heart, mind, soul, and strength. Love your neighbor as yourself. Go and make disciples of all nations. Like, if we said that's our mission, that has not changed in 2,000 years, let's be all about that. I get excited, and I do actually believe that there is a new movement of people that are taking that really seriously, having perhaps a little more creativity in how we live that out, but still having that same North Star, that same mission true. Love God, love your neighbor. Go and make disciples, and let's get after it. So I'm very hopeful. I'm very optimistic. I see a renewed sense in churches to even more passionately pursue that.
Talking Created to Flourish, How Employment-Based Solutions Eradicate Poverty. It's just one of the books, new books that Peter Greer has written. He's written a lot. He speaks regularly at conferences and travels everywhere, Africa, Asia, Latin America, and Eastern Europe, where Hope International works. Peter is president and CEO of Hope International. It's a global Christ-centered microenterprise development organization, and they're serving in a great way. You can find out more on their website, hopeinternational.org. And Peter, we always appreciate the opportunity to connect with you. Thanks for your heart and your vision and your encouragement today.
It has been so much fun. Thank you, Neil.
Peter Greer joining us today from Hope International. And we've got more ahead here on Connecting Faith. Just want to encourage you, if you missed part of this conversation, you can always find it. We post our interviews online after the show at myfaithradio.com and click on the Connecting Faith show page. Coming up in a moment, Leith Anderson makes a regular return visit, and we'll talk a little bit about the new president. And we'll talk about a couple other things, too. Just ahead, stay with us. Connecting Faith, and every other Wednesday they have the opportunity to talk church and culture with Leith Anderson, who's been president of the National Association of Evangelicals since 2006 and was a senior pastor of Wooddale Church in Eden Prairie for 35 years, written a number of books, and we're always honored to have some time to talk with Leith. Welcome back to Connecting Faith.
Hey, thank you. Good to talk to you, Neil.
Good to have you back, Leith. Ted here. And, you know, here we are in the midst of the first few days of President Trump's days in office. And clearly it seems that he will be the populist that he campaigned as. And, you know, he doesn't seem that concerned about Washington protocol. So does that change how you and the NAE team interact on the political government level at all?
Ted, you have a way of asking really big questions with a sentence or two. Wow. Well, you know, it's probably too soon to predict what this Congress and this president will do. As far as the NAE is concerned, we have a long history, 75 years this year, actually, of advocating for biblical values in Washington. And, you know, sometimes that's led to strong agreement with our government and sometimes some pretty deep disagreement. So what we'll do, no, this doesn't sound too exciting, but we'll always do what we've done, and that's stand for biblical values and religious liberty and protection of the poor, the unborn, the vulnerable, the immigrant. Our tagline at NAE is influence for good. So the way I figure it, presidents and congresses and courts, they come and they go, and they last a few years, and they're replaced, and God's word is eternal.
Yeah. Leith, we talked about religious freedom. I know this president has, at least given some indication that he would realize that that is a serious issue, but are there maybe one or two things that sort of come to the top of the agenda for you with a new administration?
Religious freedom or religious liberty is like a really big deal, and I think it's threatened in the United States. I think it's threatened around the world, and that means that it needs to be a top priority for us. And you know, what we've had is that traditional biblical Christian faith has been in a position of majority and power for a long time in the United States, and there are many quarters in which that's waning. And as it does, there are people that are kind of equating religious liberty with bigotry and with animosity, and that's just totally not true. It's in a context of wanting to love our neighbors as ourselves and being faithful to God, but to have the freedom and the liberty to do that, and it's at risk.
You know, speaking of, you know, liberty and freedom, there was a recent article in World Magazine about a disagreement among evangelicals over possible legislation called Fairness for All, and it kind of goes back to the Supreme Court's decision on same-sex marriage and maybe some religious freedom implications here for ministers and individuals. I know you're a part of some forums discussing that. I'm just wondering if you can say a little bit more about that, maybe what the objective is and why the concerns.
Well, the award just switched from Ted to you.
Yeah, okay.
All right. That is a really big question. But again, the issue is still religious liberty. As you well know, the Supreme Court has legalized same-sex marriage in the United States, and at the same time, probably of greater consequence is that there is a movement in laws and culture that is very broad, favoring a new understanding of sexual orientation and gender identity. And so what we want is to protect the beliefs and the practices of those who differ and disagree because of their religious convictions. And that's a pretty broad swath of America. This includes millions of Muslims and Mormons, all the way to Orthodox Jews and evangelical Christians. So we have 19 states that already have passed laws on sexual orientation and gender identity. And then, consider this, 60%, actually more than 60% of Americans already live under such laws through state legislation and local ordinances. So some of them have some religious freedom protections, but most of them have no such protections. So Fairness for All is an approach that acknowledges certain rights with which we may not agree, but it's in established laws already, and we want to establish laws with that protect biblical convictions in hiring and accommodations and faith practices in our churches and schools and organizations and businesses. So the idea of Fairness for All is to bring these religious liberty preferences right up there with these other changing realities in law and society. And now's the time to do it, because our religious liberty is really important.
Agreed there. You know, it occurs to me, thinking about disagreement, that there will always be disagreements to some degree. How do you approach and address positions of disagreement? I mean, are there some principles that we could all apply in our daily lives?
Well, thank you for agreeing and then talking about disagreement.
Yeah, right, yeah, there you go.
Well, you know, and we all do, that disagreements, differences, it's kind of a universal human experience. And those things can be limited by dictatorships, but they're often exaggerated by democracy because everybody's sort of got their opinion. And I got to insert in here that I just personally don't like conflict. I know there are people who do, even some Christians. They just enjoy a good fight, but that's not me. But anyway, my approach is to begin with the Bible, know what I believe, listen to the views of others, Really try to love those I disagree with and explain to them what I believe and why. And in the public sense, in public statements, one of my principles is to speak the truth but avoid criticizing other people by name. So focus on the truth rather than on the attack.
Although, you know, not everybody uses that same approach. So, I mean, it's pretty easy to get attacked, right, for anybody who says anything today. It's just most likely to get attacked by somebody. That gets a little hard to take, right? How do you not maybe take all that personally?
Well, it's hard not to take things personally, yeah. You know? Especially if you've got a commitment that you are not going to counterattack by doing the same thing to other people. You know, and I've got my convictions, and sometimes you just need to absorb the reality of people that behave in ways that I don't think are biblical or Christian. And in a sense, it gives each of us as Bible believers and as Christians an opportunity to demonstrate the way of Jesus in circumstances that we would not choose, which Jesus did repeatedly. I mean, he was attacked, he was criticized, he was crucified, and he demonstrated his truth and God's truth and what Christian faith is all about. So that's exactly what we need to do.
And perhaps the way we could do that is just to say, you know, we're going to have to agree to disagree on this point and move on, right?
Yeah, just as long as that's not a cop-out that we disagree. And it depends on what we're talking about, because in some instances, I'm not even sure I'm willing to say that I think we have levels here, Ted, and that, you know, there are some things where we just need to say, yeah, it's a difference and that's the reality. But there are some great truths and principles of human life and the place that God has as the sovereign of our world that I'm not quite ready to even say that I'm just going to disagree with you.
Yeah. Just reading through a little bit more of the article about, you know, some of these challenges in which we live and religious freedom and different viewpoints that, I mean, at the heart of the gospel, it's changing one's mind. And it's a wonderful thing that we can, in fact, do that. But, you know, we shouldn't do that lightly, right? You need to use evidence and have, I think, probably convincing arguments, right?
Well, of course, and it depends on what we're changing our mind about.
Yeah.
It's, you know, it's between Burger King and McDonald's, it's probably not a big deal. But we're talking about Christian truth and Christian doctrine. I think we should be really slow to change our mind and to start with what the scriptures have to say, not with what the person that we're talking to has to say. You know that great verse in the Old Testament that what does God require of us? To act justly, Micah 6:8, to love mercy, and to walk humbly with your God. And walking humbly with God is with God, so it's what he says and what his authoritative word teaches us. But to walk humbly also says, you know, I can't be so sure of myself that it's all about me. I can't be a narcissist. I can't be a know-it-all. Humility means I may be wrong and that I may need to change my mind. But let's be cautious when we're talking about essential absolute truths.
Which is what the National Association of Evangelicals has been advocating for biblical values for 75 years. And honored to spend some time again with Leith Anderson, who joins us every other Wednesday to give us an update. It's nae.net, right?
Nae.net. And there's everything from podcasts to instructions and all kinds of things. So check it out.
NAE.net, Leith Anderson, president of the National Association of Evangelicals, longtime pastor at Wooddale Church in Eden Prairie, Minnesota for over 35 years, and has written 20 books and joins us to talk church and culture here on a regular basis. Our time is gone for today. Just want to remind you that tomorrow we're going to talk about the story of reality. You know, biblical Christianity isn't just an interesting idea or concept, but it is, in fact, reality. And we're going to learn more about how the world began, how it ends, and everything important that happens in between. We're going to get that all done in an hour.
It'll be a feat.
Yeah, it's going to be good. Greg Kuchel will join us from Stand to Reason, and he'll help us get the big picture. So I'd encourage you to join us tomorrow for a great discussion. Greg's a wonderful apologist, and we'll get some great insight tomorrow. And, of course, you can hear these interviews or many more if you go to our podcast at the Connecting Faith Show page at myfaithradio.com.